session number 25266, Reel 1.
Michael, thank you very much for agreeing to contribute to the Imperial War Museum Sound Archive. Could I start, please, by asking you to start with your service number and your date of birth, first of all, please?
Well, I remember it was Cadet Michael James Graydon, 607932, the lowest form of life at the RAF College, Cranwell. And I was born on the 24th of October, 1938.
And where were you born?
Kew, Surrey.
And your parents, what did they do?
My father, at the time, was, I think, in the motor business. Not absolutely certain. Because I think in 1939, he was either called up or joined up. And went off to war. And I think by 1940 he was probably in Egypt, and I think I saw him again in 1945. So I didn't see much of him in my formative years. My mother was obviously living in or around Kew at the time and moved during wartime to Richmond. What was it called? No, it's called Kingston Vale, but it was by near Richmond Park, to be near her sister. And her sister was also married. They had me and my cousin were born in the same year. She was married to somebody in the Royal Air Force who was killed in about 1941 or 2, I think. And they lived near each other during the whole of the war.
Any experiences, any memories of your own?
Of the war?
Of the end of the war?
Oh, I have some, probably embellished a bit over the years, but I have some very, very vivid memories of as a little boy sitting in the flat in which we lived, looking out over and towards Richmond Park with the searchlights playing and seeing an aeroplane caught in the searchlights, a bit like a moth, and seeing the tracer going up. And I remember seeing the doodlebugs. Always told by my mother, you hear these things and then it stops and then get down. And I remember having to get down a couple of times because they were around. I mean, we had houses were bombed across the street from us, and of course everything was blacked out. And all of that I remember quite well. Air raid shelters.
And post-war rationing, wartime rationing.
A little story my mother always tells. You know, I never had an egg until 1945 or 6, and when she very proudly got hold of this egg and put it in front of me, I turned up my nose. I much preferred to have the powdered egg that we'd had. Yes.
And where did you go to school?
Initially, very close to, there was a little school, and I noticed it's still there when I pass, going down towards the A3, on the edge of the common opposite Richmond Park. I remember that, but then I went off, and this was probably about 1943, to a school in Putney with my cousin, which was an amazing school because they obviously had a very sort of ambitious headmaster. But I remember we were studying Latin and you know, doing sort of declensions and God knows what in Latin at the age of, well, quite young, 5, 6, something like that. It was a real powerhouse of a school, which my cousin found all too much and used to run away from it quite regularly. And then I was sent, when my father came home, I was sent off to boarding school down at a place called Tadworth. It's a place called Chinhurst School. And then subsequently they moved down to that part of the world from Kingston Vale to a place called Kingswood in Surrey. And I was then a day pupil at that preparatory school until I was 12. And then I was shipped off to boarding school down in the West Country at a place called Wycliffe College, where I then did a suitable time.
Did you enjoy?
Did I enjoy school or did
yes,
I...
Yes, did you enjoy college?
I enjoyed school, really. The Glengyle, which was the name of the first one, was a hothouse. I didn't remember anything other than just work. The prep school was fun. It was a co-ed, interestingly enough. And obviously I did enough work to pass the common entrance. But I did a lot of sport there. I was quite a good sportsman. And my school, my public school, I remember, well, again, I did quite well. I got down to work when I was about 15 and started working hard then and got all the right examination results and GCSEs. You know, they call them O levels and A levels, don't they? So I got all that lot. But I was also a very good sportsman and played a lot of sport, captained cricket and rugby and so on. And so I had a pretty good time at school, really. Yes, I think I did. And it was about halfway through schooling that I suddenly got this interest in flying. And it was born very quickly because living next door to my parents in Kingswood was a very interesting man called Bob Mayer, who, for those who are aficionados of flying in the 1930s, will remember a thing called the short Mayo composite aircraft, which was in fact the precursor of the shuttle. It carried another airplane on its back and launched it. And it was a seaplane from another airplane and launched this thing off. And it then flew across the Atlantic, as I recall. But he used to take me to air shows. And there I met all the wonderful heroes of that early 1950s, when Great Britain had an amazing, amazing airplane industry. I mean, there were dozens and dozens, it seemed, of people producing airplanes, from Fairies to Saunders Row to Hawkers to Supermarine to you name it, they produced an airplane. And they were all at Farnborough. Farnborough was alive with interesting and new airplanes. And I could tell them by heart. I knew every airplane by heart. I knew all these pilots. And I met some of these pilots through Bob Mayer. And I thought, this is it. This is fantastic. I've got to do this. And he said, if you really want to do this, and I think Neville Duke, who was a very famous test pilot of that era, probably enforced it, said, if you want to learn to fly, my boy, join the Royal Air Force. So I thought, okay. You know, I hadn't got any interest in the Royal Air Force, but if that's what you have to do, then I'll go and do it. And at the age of 15, I went up to Cranwell. They just introduced a thing called the Cranwell Scholarship, the aim of which was, if you were sufficiently adept at whatever it is they wanted you to do there, you had to have the academics, but you also had to demonstrate other qualities. They'd give you a scholarship which would enable you to stay at school, assist your father in paying the fees, and then you'd go to Cranwell at the age of 17 or 18 and join it. And all that sounded pretty good to me, so I went off and did this thing, and to my astonishment got this scholarship. I was only 15. And then I came back and was told all about this. I said, well, that's fine. My father always used to say, ironically, it was the most useless thing that I could possibly have done, because he had a salary at the time which was judged to be more than they would pay, so he didn't get a penny for this damn scholarship at all, which he thought was pretty awful. And because there was no really record of it, I mean, what they said was they expected you to be paying money. So if they'd been paying money, they would have had a direct interest, and there'd have been communication between my father and or whoever, and the Royal Air Force. But there wasn't. So age 15, got the scholarship, no money forthcoming, and so I did another 2.5 years at school. And, you know, it was fine. And then I thought, well, I suppose I'll be leaving school soon. I better go do national service, because national service was on. And then suddenly I got this letter saying, you know, you've got all your exam results, report to Cranwell. And this was for September 1956. And, yes, it was 56. And the headmaster said, you can't do that. He said, we want you to stay on for the rugby season. We've got a really good rugby team here. You know. So we wrote back to Cranwell and said, he can't come in September, but he can come in January. And they said, all right then. So I stayed for another 3 months and played rugby. there we are.
And that really is your introduction to the RAF?
Yes, it was almost by chance going to Cranwell. You know, I had no idea what Cranwell. And as for permanent commissions and all of that, I just wanted to fly.
And what was Cranwell like when you got there?
Bloody miserable. The whole idea was to make people who arrived there as miserable as possible for a year, or the best part of a year. You were a junior entry, and junior entries were to be bullied, beaten, abused, and just generally made to feel that what the hell were they doing there. And of course it was all part of seeing A, whether you got the character to stand it, and B, that you would bond with everybody there. And of course that's the way the services operate. So it wasn't idle, although some of it was pretty brutal, frankly. I mean, you'd never get away with it now. Never, never. But we survived, and I don't think we're the worst for it.
And do you think servicemen today are the worst for it? in the sense that the way that people are treated and trained today is so different from those days. Do you think there has been any loss at all?
I think there's a general loss, and I don't think I'd confine it to services. In fact, I would almost exempt the services from that. I think what's missing in today's world is risk. We've got ourselves into a sort of politically correct situation. And I say this based on, because I sit on what's called the Air Cadet Council. One of the great organisations in this country is the Air Cadets. And we have some 40,000 youngsters in the Air Cadets, girls and boys, for whom the adventurous training that we give them there is about the only adventurous training, the only chance that they have to get into an environment where there's some risk. Now, nobody wants risk for its own sake, but, you know, young people need risk to grow up. If you eliminate risk from everything, you are going to be pathetic, ultimately. And I think we have got a really dangerous culture, and it stems from much wider things than military. It's the culture of blame. Somebody's got to be blamed for everything. Things happen. Yes, you can minimise risk, but to eliminate it is impossible, and I think stupid. So to go back to your question, I think youngsters today have been so immunised from this in some areas. I mean, I think one of the great benefits of private education still is that they do it. One of the great benefits of the cadets is it provides that opportunity for people from all walks of life, and long may it continue. But so many of the state schools now, there is no opportunity for it, and I think they're the losers. So when some of those youngsters come into the service, it's a pretty rude shock, because the service actually does, for commas, encourage risk. I mean, it's part of the game. You know, if you go to be a soldier or sailor or an airman, there's risk, ultimate risk, giving your life.
So you survived what, in effect, was just two terms at Cranwell, possibly, before you ceased to be a junior entrant?
We had a year, because there were only... My year had... There used to be three entries a year. And we were the second one. So the first lot, entry number 75 for us, only had 3 months. We then came in, so we were the juniors, so they were much better off. And then we had the rest of that year before the next lot came in. So I suppose, do we have a year? Maybe we had a junior entry after 9 months or something. But we had, you know, quite a long time to be the pits.
And after you'd survived that, what then did Cranwell do and offer you?
It was a three-year course. Yeah. Yeah. It really was an attempt. And in today's world, if Cranwell still existed today, it would be a degree course. In those days, the universities were totally reactionary to any idea that you could actually get a degree other than going for 3 years to university. Now they give them away on paper. But then they didn't. And they would not recognise the course at Cranwell as a university course. But nevertheless, that's what it was. The difference being that we were taught to fly at the same time. So the first year was academics, an incredible amount of drill, and learning how to use navigation equipment in airplanes so that you understood, you know, navigation. That was the first year. Second year, more academics, less drill, but nevertheless every day. And flying. We were taught that year to fly the Piston Provost, which was called basic flying training, I think. And that took a full year, three terms. Very university-type things, although the holidays were nothing like as grand as they get at universities. And then the final year, which is when you start to be given quite a lot of responsibilities and things, again, more academics, minimal drill, really, because you were doing the drill on people, mainly. And then we flew a thing called the Vampire. And at the end of that, we graduated as pilot officers with wings, plus a permanent commission in the Royal Air Force. In today's terms, that would have been also with a degree, but we didn't get it then.
What was the failure rate, if I can call it that, among those who were training to fly, or for any other reason?
The failure rate varied. My particular course had a very high failure rate for a number of reasons. We had amongst us not just those who flew, we also had a number of administrators and supply officers, not a lot, but a number, and navigators as well. So pilots, navigators, administrators and supply officers. This was an innovation, because previously it had all been I think, right in saying it had all been aircrew, so supply and administrators were trained elsewhere, as were engineers at Henlow. Subsequently, they amalgamated everything and put it at Cramwell, which was, in fact, very sensible. But the Air Force was a big Air Force. I mean, when I joined it, it must have been, I'm guessing, somewhere between 150, 200 plus thousand people. I reduced the Air Force when I took it over. It was about 89,000, and I had to bring it down to 56,000 by the time I left office. So you can see, I mean, it was about, quarter the size of the Air Force that I joined, I suspect, in that region. There were commands from the Far East, Hong Kong, the Far East, the Middle East, all over, the Near East, airplanes in Africa, and then, of course, a massive people in Germany. So, I mean, it was a big, big Air Force with all those interesting horizons. I suspect we lost at least 30% of the entry in one way or another. There were two or three were killed, sadly. I would think 20% of them failed the flying course, at least, and various other offences or failures. Some of them were recourse, pushed down a bit. For example, chaps who failed the flying course were quite often pushed to the next entry and became something else, a navigator or spy officer or something. Yes.
But that still happened.
Indeed it did. Indeed it did. Yes. 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 Yep.
So you are, you've achieved the exalted rank of pilot officer, yep. The one thin stripe.
Yes. Very thin.
Very thin. This is the end of 56.
No, the end of 1959. So I went there beginning of 57. The end of 59. Yes.
End of 59. What was your first posting, and did you have any choice at all?
You were asked to put what you wanted, and I think we all put down fighters because the Hunter was the great aeroplane then. But I was told that I was going to be a flying instructor. It was something that they just started again. They tried it, what's called the first tour instructor. The reason for it was because they were short of instructors, possibly, people didn't want to be instructors or something. Mm-hmm. But anyway, they were short, and so this seemed to be a quick way or an easy way to fill. And I was assured that it was a great feather in my cap to be chosen as a flying instructor. I thought it was frightful, Good God, I'm going to be a bloody instructor. But from my entry, there were two of us who were sent off to be flying instructors, and we went after a short hold to the Central Flying School at Little Risington in Gloucestershire, and had about 4 or 5 months there. And then I was posted to fly with the Royal Navy at Number 1 Flying Training School, which was purely for the Royal Navy, or the Fleet Air Arm to be precise, which of course was the flying arm of the Royal Navy, which was a terrific experience. I think I didn't know what to expect. But I benefited hugely from, being with a mix. The instructors were RAF and Navy, but the environment was Navy. And although it was on a Royal Air Force station, everything about it was Navy. So I had the privilege of instructing with naval pilots. The Navy didn't do much flying. When you fly off the carrier, I don't mean that in any derogatory sense. In comparison to the amount of flying that you got on an RAF tour, flying off a carrier, firstly, damn dangerous, and secondly, the trips were very short, and the carrier would go off on a particular thing to the Middle East or the Far East, and there'd be a certain amount of flying, and that would be it. So some of these guys were coming back with perhaps only about 600 hours flying, but nevertheless, some pretty interesting flying. So I was pilot officer with lots of lieutenants, Royal Navy, and some flight lieutenants, Royal Air Force, and I made the coffee for quite a long time.
So, but as well as in between your coffee duties, you also, of course, had to learn the difficult skill of landing and taking off in a tiny space.
No, I didn't. I must be clear about that. What I did was just teach them to fly. They then went off to the operational conversion unit and learnt to do the bit landing on carriers, so I can take no credit for that.
Did you ever do that yourself?
I've landed on the carrier a couple of times, and I was lucky enough to go and fly the Seahawk up at Lossiemouth, which is when they had it. So we used to do the sort of carrier-type landings up there. But landing an aeroplane individually, a modern aeroplane, onto a carrier, I've not personally done it.
Right. So you haven't had the thrill of the missing the wire, or whatever it is? Go round again?
No, but I've landed... I mean, the nearest thing, when I was in the Falklands, commanding the Falklands, we had a tin runway, which used to land the F-4 Phantom onto, and... that was short, and we landed with a hook, exactly the same. You know, you had to catch the the wire, and we only had one as opposed to three.
After your period as an instructor, what next beckoned? And again, I'm interested in the question of choice, because would I be correct at this stage that you're thinking about making the RAF you have a permanent commission,
yes,
but that it might become a permanent career, or when did that idea possibly gel, if it had not yet gelled?
I guess I started to suddenly realise actually this is quite a serious business when I was at Central Flying School, because I had to work damned hard to keep up with all the chaps who were much, you know, more experienced than me. And at the at Linton, I took my promotion exams to flight lieutenant, and I worked very hard for those, and I passed them. So I became, by the time I left Linton, I was flight lieutenant. As Cramwell got slightly accelerated promotion, I was only 1 year as a pilot officer, so I became a flying officer, thicker ring, after a year, and then I think it was 18 months if you passed your examinations, maybe 2 years, I can't remember, to be a flight lieutenant. So certainly within 3 years of leaving Cramwell, you could be a flight lieutenant. Although, as all the hairy old chaps used to tell me, you're not a serious flight lieutenant yet. but at least I wasn't making the coffee any longer. And, you know, I wasn't a bad instructor. I became an A2 instructor. I taught a lot of really excellent young men, and including, I was looking at my logbook the other day, when I was Chief of Air Staff, one of my colleagues was a chap called Ben Bathurst, First Sea Lord. He started off as Vice Chief of Defence Staff, and then he became First Sea Lord in my time. We served together. Good friends. And I taught him, I didn't teach him exclusively fly, but I certainly taught him quite a lot of vampire flying when he was a sub-lieutenant. No, he was a lieutenant, actually, going through the course at Linton on Ouse. So a number of people subsequently I've met.
Right.
And about the last 6 months I was there, I think I did 2.5 years with that. I always used to put down fighters, you know, on my dream sheet, hunters, whatever. But I went off to see a friend of mine, and they just got the Lightning in 1962, I think, 61, 62. The Lightning was arriving on fighter squadrons, only about two or three of them, very new and, you know, pretty unserviceable. But it was awesome, as they say. And I thought, well, this will be quite fun. So I put hunters or Lightnings. And at the time, I think they felt that you had to be superhuman to fly these things, because they wrote down, you know, to fly Lightning, you've got to be assessed as above the average and have at least 1,000 hours flying. Well, I was above the average and I got 1,000 hours flying. So they were selecting people like me, ex-first tourists, to go and fill some of these posts on the Lightning squadrons. So I was sent off to Chivna to learn to fly the Hunter, which I loved. Fantastic airplane. Then was sent off to 56 Squadron, which had got Lightnings, although we still had some Hunters on the base, and some Meteors, actually, as well. And converted onto the Lightning and joined 56 Squadron in 1963.
In 63.
Mm.
So as a flight lieutenant, you were serving there. What were your duties and tasks, and what, as well as masses of training, I expect, you were also engaged, I don't want to ask a leading question, so I must stop. What were your...
Right, well, the Lightning squadrons were air defence, all-weather air defence. The Hunter was a day fighter. It had no radar. Wonderful aeroplane, fantastic aeroplane, wonderful for dogfighting and also became an extremely good ground attack aircraft, but in no way could you call it an all-weather airplane. You know, you couldn't see in cloud and you couldn't see at night. So we had a thing called the Javelin, which was the all-weather fighter, but it was a two-seater, incidentally, and was not a bad airplane, but its handling characteristics would say at least a little quaint. And by the time 1963 or so was along, it was on its way out. It was an old airplane. So the Lightning, which had started life as an experimental airplane, was just in a different league. I mean, A, it was seriously supersonic, very supersonic. You would almost go supersonic in the climb. Very, very fast airplane. Single seat, integrated radar system, very high workload. And that's one of the reasons why they thought you had to be superhuman to do it.
Can I stop you there and ask you, what is a high workload? What exactly does a high workload mean?
Well, a high workload means that you've got things to do with that airplane, interpretations. For example, the radar was the thing that you used to put yourself in a position to fire the missiles to knock down the enemy bombers. They required two people to do that in the Javelin, one concentrating on the radar, the other flying the airplane. It was deemed that one person could do it. The airplane was quite a handful to fly, but it was considered, well, you should do that, shouldn't you? Now get on and operate this radar and do both. So that's the sort of workload that was required. You're having to do a number of things at once. For example, the hand controller, which controlled everything, it was a multifunctional thing, and you had to operate. Every single finger was used to operate a particular switch on that. So, you know, you had to know what you were doing. I think it had something like 20 different functions on it. Now, kids of today are used to those days. That was almost unheard of.
And you were keeping an eye then on Russian long-range bombers that flew round the top of Norway, I suppose.
Well, that was the manifestation of it. I mean, what it was all about was providing the air defence of the United Kingdom in case of attack. We had no intention, never, to promote a war. But the belief was at the time that the Russians might, the Soviet Union might. After all, they were pressed up against the Berlin Wall, which was there by then. And there was plenty of examples of, you know, things that had happened there which showed that they might, if they felt they could get away with it, take the rest of Europe. So part of that would have been an attack on the United Kingdom, which held the great deterrent to war, which was the bomber fleet at the time in the 1960s.
Which carried the deterrent.
So we had to defend. Our primary purpose was to defend that deterrent so that the deterrent could get off and do the business. That meant that we had areas to defend, go down, stop their bombers getting through there and launch their missiles or whatever they were going to do to take out our bomber bases. And a very comprehensive radar system throughout the whole of the country into which we were totally integrated. So you had the radar system, the fighters, and behind that the Bloodhound missiles as part of the integrated air defence system, I suppose, as it was.
By the standards of the day, would this have been described as state of the art? In other words, it really worked well, did it?
It had two weaknesses. I think it was as good as anything in the world, and the Lightning in its day was the best in the world. There was nothing faster than the Lightning, and I think its radar, although in today's terms, was not that good. I mean, the sort of detection ranges on a bomber were 25 miles or so, which sounds quite a lot, but when you're doing, you know, mark 1 point something and the other thing steaming towards you at 0.8 mark, it doesn't take long for it to go. And if it had got a standoff missile, you had to get in and get it very quickly. So,
if your opponent had a standoff.
Yes.
What is a standoff missile?
That was a missile that would be launched from the belly of the bomber, and the Russians did have some, which would then go ahead of the bomber and bash onto the bomber base.
Oh, I see.
The problem being that we didn't know whether they would be nuclear or conventional. If the conventional, it probably wouldn't have been that accurate. But if it was nuclear, didn't have to be that accurate, you know. So this was the great unknown. Were we going to be launched into nuclear war from the word go? We, if you remember, in the days of deterrence, were intending to go, if we were attacked, we're going to go to war with nuclear weapons. Yes. And it wasn't until 1967, I think, when flexible response through Kennedy, I think Kennedy started to introduce it a bit earlier, that the flexible response, which said, actually, this isn't a very smart idea. We ought to, if we're attacked conventionally, we really ought to be able to defend conventionally. It's only when we're really up against it that we might consider nuclear weapons. Beforehand, it was, touch me and I'll whack you with a nuclear weapon, which, was it believable?
But is language that the Russians understand, though?
Well, there was a view. I mean, it's also language that the Americans understood, you know, the great